Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville.
The planes hit in New York City. Thousands now are dead. It was Arab terrorists. This is what you said. Well, if that is the case, then what have you got to hide? What were you doing on the day all those people died? Where the fuck were the fighter jets ordered by the FAA? And what is your explanation for what you were heard to say when you told the Air Force to stand down, not to intercept? Did you plan to let it happen, or are you just inept? There's some distressing information, sir, which I think should be explained. Just which things have been lost and just what has been gained, like the thousands of put options bought days before the crash. If the money were collected, it'd make quite a pretty stash. And the only stocks they bought were American and United. Deutsche Bank knows the answer, but the names have not been cited. And is it just coincidence that this firm in the private sector was once run by Buzzy Krongard, now a CIA director? And I am left to wonder, as the flames are rising higher, was this our latest Lusitania or another Reichstag fire? There's something fishy in Virginia, and I want an explanation. Why did they get the contract? What is Britannia Aviation? A one-man operation, corporation with no history. He said he worked in Florida, but there he was a mystery. So is there a connection? I think it bears investigation. When the FAA found box cutters, this has caused you consternation. Hidden behind the seats in those Delta planes that had been fixed in Lynchburg with Britannia at the reins. And I am left to wonder, as the flames are rising higher, was this our latest Lusitania or another Reichstag fire? You said bin Laden was your friend, but he isn't anymore. Now that he's not fighting Russia in your proxy war, who called the FBI off the bin Laden family trail when so many times you had the chance to rewrite this sordid tale? Sudan in 96, the Taliban in 2001 offered to turn him over, and right then you could have won. But perhaps it is the case that you're avoiding victory, that to justify your exploits you must have an enemy. And I am left to wonder, as the flames are rising higher, was this our latest Lusitania or another Reichstag fire? If you were not hiding from the truth, then you'd have a truth commission, not some masquerade kangaroo investigation hiring Henry Kissinger, the ancient master of deceit, to make sure all stones are left unturned and the ruse is kept complete. Now you carry out your plans, which you have had for decades, conquering the world with your troops and bombing raids. I see an evil regime led by an evil man on Pennsylvania Avenue, where this evil war began. And I am left to wonder, as the flames are rising higher, was this our latest Lusitania or another Reichstag fire?
David Rovics performing his song Reichstag Fire live at the International Inquiry on 9/11 last March in San Francisco. We return to our presentation of the inquiry to moderator Barry Zwicker as he introduces the next speaker.
The next speaker is Webster Tarpley. Webster's an author and lecturer, and he began his study of terrorism in Italy in the 1970s. And there was a lot of terrorism in Italy in the 1970s. There was the Bologna train station outrage and the Red Brigades and neo-fascist terrorism. And at that time, they were called the Years of Lead by the Italians. In that time, in 1978, Webster was asked by a minister of the Italian government to look into what happened with the kidnapping and murder of Aldo Moro, with a particular attention to the media. And he wrote a book then that year called Who Killed Aldo Moro? And not to give it away too much, but he came to the conclusion that Moro was killed by U.S., British, and NATO intelligence, which was not the story at the time. Moro's widow, by the way, told Webster that Henry Kissinger, who was implicated in this and is mentioned in the book, had personally delivered death threats to her husband. In 1991, Webster edited and co-authored a study, The Administrative Fascism Under the Bush Regime. That was under Bush 41. And he looked into, of course, Panama, which happened under Bush 41, and the beginnings or the continuation of the growth of the police state, the combination of aggression and repression that we see even more today. Perhaps, though, he's best known these days for his book, George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography, which was published in July 1992 and has sold 25,000 copies, but he put it on the internet in 1996, and apparently it has been downloaded by the millions, maybe 50,000 a month and as high as 150,000 a month. So it is an excellent book. And Webster has a PowerPoint presentation, and I wish him good luck with that. And without further ado, Webster Tarpley, author and lecturer.
Thank you very much. I would like to begin by thanking Carol Brulé in particular and the organizers of this wonderful event, for their courage and their energy and the great merit that they have in addressing what is, I believe, the greatest political issue of our time. And I'd like to thank everybody who has contributed to this. And certainly thank you for allowing me to come here. I would like to talk about the question of terrorism as it relates to the policies of the Bush regime, and to put this in historical context, we're often told by great philosophers of history like Donald Rumsfeld that history began anew on September 11, 2001, that everything before that is completely irrelevant, and that the world was essentially reborn as a creature of hell on September 11th. And I would say that is simply not true, that history remains in action. Now, whether my laptop remains in action. All right. Let us first address what I would like to call the 9/11 myth. It is, I submit, a fantastic construct. It is the story of the 19 hijackers, bin Laden, the laptop in the cave, and so forth. This myth has now become the basis of the government of the United States. The two are inextricably linked. And the survival of the myth is, of course, the key to the re-usurping campaign of the current tenant of the White House. I choose my words carefully. And I would submit to you that the overriding political priority for every person of goodwill on this planet is to dismantle this myth, to critique it, to deconstruct it, and to put it into the dustbin of history. I would further suggest that if the 9/11 myth cannot be deconstructed, that the current tenant of the White House is likely to remain in place. And I invite you to pause for a second and think about what such a perspective would mean. It essentially means a second term beyond the reach of public opinion with bureaucratic, authoritarian, totalitarian tendencies even stronger than the ones we see today. Now, already Doonesbury, back when it was Ari Fleischer, was able to see that the 9/11 story was the answer to every question at the White House briefing. This is back when it was Ari Fleischer. We see that the people are asking questions. I don't know if this is legible, but they're essentially asking questions about budgets and health care, and the answer is 9/11, 9/11, 9/11. And if you have a follow-up, the answer to that is 9/11, too. Here it is again. Now it's not Ari anymore, it's Scott, but the story is still the same. 9-11, 9-11. So is it going to be 9-11? Yes, it's 9-11, 24-7. And the correspondents then reply 10-4. Now, Franklin D. Roosevelt once told us that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. The current tenant of the White House tells us that we have to be afraid, deathly afraid, all the time. It is, if you will, a new reign of terror being brought about by the Bush people. Now, my story, as Mr. Zwicker very kindly noted in his introduction, my initiation to the study of terrorism began as the study of international terrorism in Europe in the late 1970s, and in particular, the Moro case in 1978. This was the kidnapping and murder of the former Italian prime minister. And the cover of this study is the attempt that I made at that time to convey, in the conditions of that country at that time, that the agency that had carried out the kidnapping and murder was NATO intelligence, the combination of the United States, the British, and their friends inside the secret services of the NATO alliance. When Moro had been kidnapped, the Italian newspapers were sent a photograph of him with a flag in the background that said Red Brigades. So what we did was to take out the Red Brigades and put in the British flag here to suggest that the agency that had kidnapped him was very much in the West. And has been mentioned, his widow later reported that he had been threatened very directly and very personally by Henry Kissinger, saying, if you don't stop what you're doing, there's going to be big trouble for you. I'm imitating Henry Kissinger, not some other personality. During the Bush 41, I called them Bush 41 and Bush 43. And people sometimes ask, oh, what are you referring to, their IQ or their bowling score? It's Bush, the 41st president of the United States, and then the 43rd. American Leviathan, the totalitarian state, administrative fascism under the Bush regime. This is my major work, George Bush, the Unauthorized Biography. I would submit that it still stands as the only thorough, comprehensive, and critical biography of the former president. It was issued in 1992, and it has been available since October 1996 for free to download on the internet. So if you haven't downloaded it, please do. It's been downloaded millions of times, and it's been pirated hundreds of times, so much so that it doesn't make any sense to shut down my site because there are so many others. Now, I would like to begin with a theoretical discussion of terrorism before we get into the question of the Nazi links of the Bush family. We are now entering the wilderness of mirrors. We are now entering a world where deception is the primary concern of all practitioners. I call this state-sponsored terrorism because I am convinced that much terrorism in the modern world is state-sponsored terrorism. And the United States government is no stranger to this phenomenon. Now, if I could just get my briefcase here, I realize that I've come out here without my laser pointer, which leaves me at a severe disadvantage. And I don't know whether anybody back there can hear me. Thank you so much. What I'm trying to suggest with this chart is that terrorism cannot be understood as a simple phenomenon. It is rather a complex phenomenon. And I suggest that it's made up of three subsystems, if you will, or three subgroups, inside a universe of discourse which is controlled in the manner of brainwashing by the controlled corporate media and their systematic falsifications. Now, the first group I would point to within this universe of discourse, right? Here's the whole universe of discourse. The patsies. The people that are going to take the fall for terrorist actions, that are going to be accused, that are going to be put in jail, executed, and so forth, are generally mental wrecks that we can qualify as patsies, dupes, useful idiots, fanatics. They're interspersed with police agents, double agents, provocateurs, Oswalds, if you will. They are, it helps if they're borderline psychotics. It helps if they have something to do, some inkling or smattering of what they're accused of doing. But generally, these are people of very limited mental equipment who are suggestible, who are manipulable, and who are guided into certain things. If they don't do them, those things can be done by doubles, and they can then be blamed on them. And if you need to do it on a larger scale, you can set up a group of patsies, perhaps led by a conscious agent, or you can set up a false flag operation that is all agents but pretends to be one of the same group as the patsies. These people often do a great deal to get themselves noticed, like Oswald. Remember leafleting, going on the radio? They have to get into fights with people. They have to be abrasive. They have to be noticeable. They're ideologues. They talk a lot. These are the people that are going to be blamed for the action. And the critical question, of course, is always, are they physically capable of carrying out the action that they are accused of? However, there's another group, the moles. This lady in the, well, this FBI agent, Colleen Rowley, at one point said, "We thought that our bosses in FBI headquarters were a bunch of moles." Well, moles would be, and I think this is an important point, a private network of operatives who have penetrated the government. In other words, it's a group of people who are not loyal to the constitutional chain of command, but to the orders that are coming from some command center outside, so a private network. It is not the case, in my view, that the entire United States command structure, let us say, could be actively, knowingly complicit in something like 9/11. As Machiavelli writes in his book on conspiracy, the main problem with conspiracies is you can't let too many people into them, because then they will be blown. So it's rather people at key nodal points, the man who runs the Islamic Fundamentalist Department of the FBI, the security director of the Federal Aeronautics Administration, the head of the North American Air Defense Command. These are the ones that we have to look at in the guise of moles who are responding to commands and instructions from a private network outside. The one thing that I would say is that once the terrorist action has taken place, if it is successful, it will increasingly seem as if the moles have taken over the entire government, which is what, of course, they intend to do. So as you look back on it historically, it will look more and more like the moles have taken over everything. And part of that is simply the bureaucratic inertia and the bureaucratic self-preservation of the bureaucratic structures in which the moles are ensconced. Now, everybody hears about the patsies, but nobody hears about the professional killers unless things go very, very wrong. It happened in Britain in the past 12 months. It turned out that one of the main killers of a Protestant terror group was actually an agent of MI5. These are the professional killers. They are technicians. They are CIA and Special Forces old boys. And there's this interesting term, the asteroids. This came up after the Iran-Contra scandal that has just been mentioned, the reorganization of the intelligence community at the beginning of the 1990s, essentially focused on a group of private intelligence functions. Remember, under Ronald Reagan's executive order 12333 at the beginning of his presidency, U.S. intelligence is privatized. It exists to a very large degree as private security companies, private investigating, private intelligence, beltway bandits, whatever you want to call it. Those are the asteroids. So the idea is that the actions that are going to be carried out will be carried out by the professional killers. These are, of course, hardened murderers or expert technicians, as the case may be. But they're not ideologues, they're not fanatics, they don't talk, and their desire is to remain behind the scenes. Whereas it's the patsies that are going to go out and take the hit. Before the action takes place, the task of the moles is to make sure that nobody interferes with the patsies. The patsies have got to be as public as possible and as visible as possible, but at the same time, they can't be thrown in jail. Otherwise, they can't fulfill their function. Once the crime has been committed, the task of the moles is to mercilessly indict, imprison, execute, accuse these same patsies. and if necessary, they have to be eliminated, right? Oswald said, I never killed anybody, no sir, and he was dead soon after that. So these people are expendable. These people may be expendable too, but it doesn't take place in public, so we know very little of it. And again, none of this can happen without the brainwashed world of the controlled corporate media. Now, I just wanted to mention one example. If you'd like to study this, the only movie that I know of that talks about this in anything like realistic terms is a movie called The Package. It has Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman is a good sergeant, a good government employee who realizes that there's a network of moles. But you do see in this movie the moles. The moles are a group of U.S. and Soviet officers who want to kill Gorbachev, stop disarmament, stop detente. There's a group of dupes. There's a U.S. Army private who becomes the head of a neo-Nazi group in Chicago. And then there are professional killers. The professional killer in this case is Bobby Lee Jones, I believe. So you get the idea with this. If you'd like to see a means of teaching people the ABCs of how this works, I think this is possibly a means of doing that. Now, in the past couple of days, we've had the sessions of the Kane-Hamilton Commission. And I would just say, this is a colossal exercise in a logical fallacy called begging the question. Begging the question, petitio principi, as we say in Latin, they were throwing Latin around, very bad Latin, in this Delenda report. They assume what has to be proven. In other words, you're told, prove the official story of 9/11. What they do then is assume the official story is 9/11 as given, and then go on to show how that this is actually the case. So this is simply a logical fallacy. Now, it doesn't rule out the possibility that interesting things may come up along the way, but this is largely coincidental because the entire thrust of the exercise goes in the opposite direction. So I suggest to you that this is a bankrupt experiment. And I would offer the following reality check, especially for the Kane-Hamilton people. There is no proof, no convincing proof, no proof of any kind, really, in the public domain that September 11th can be attributed to Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, or anything of the sort. Embarrassing for Colin Powell, he promised a white book. It never came out. There's no connection to Afghanistan. Director Mueller of the FBI has admitted that. There's no proof of who the hijackers were. There's no proof that there were any hijackers. There's no proof of foreign origin of the attacks. And nobody but nobody has ever been convicted for this in any shape or form in any kind of a trial. One distinguished skeptic was the former Chancellor of Germany, Helmut Schmidt, who said after the NATO conference had invoked the self-defense clause, collective defense, he said, in order to do that, you've got to provide proof that the attack came from outside of the country involved. And this was never done. So the proof had never been provided in December of 2001, and the proof still has not been provided. Now, I would just like to establish as a basis of discussion 14 points. I'll try to do them very quickly. I'm sure that they've been addressed, and there are people who know much more about each one of these than I do. But just to get an idea, the official version, I would suggest, breaks down on 14 major points, 14 being a nice round number. I also, apologies to Woodrow Wilson, but I won't apologize to Woodrow Wilson. An old imperialist and a hypocrite at that. The thing here is I also propose these as 14 panels. This my hidden agenda, which I now reveal, is that these would be 14 panels of the Independent International Truth Commission on 9/11, which I hope can be held in August or September after the existing initiatives have been completed. The first one, of course, is why were the alleged terrorists not arrested before the fact? And simply the notion that they could get away with breaking the laws and running amok for so long in such a flagrant and blatant way suggests that they have been protected by a network of moles, the moles in the FBI that ignored the Minneapolis report, the Phoenix memorandum, and so forth, the moles that Colleen Rowley complained about. Here are, of course, the 19. Nobody knows really anything about them. There are reports that 7 of them are still alive. Those have been denied, but the denials are not convincing. The other very interesting question about these 19 characters, whoever they were, is how were the alleged terrorists physically capable of carrying out the alleged actions? And that means, how do you take over an aircraft with plastic knives, box cutters, or anything of the sort, when you have to remember that all the pilots are generally military officers, and if you just spend a little time in an aircraft, as I have today, you see that it just somehow doesn't seem to make sense that four people could hold off a group of 50 or 60. Handbags, as Margaret Thatcher has shown, handbags are a tremendous weapon, and just one handbag can be just as good as a box cutter in fighting at close quarters. Therefore, we have questions like, were these planes replaced by drones? The distinguished German researcher Gerhard Wisniewski has advanced the hypothesis that they were replaced by drone aircraft. Others have argued that they were controlled, remote controlled, by the Global Hawk technology and ran into the buildings that way. The question, of course, is a supermarket caliber terrorist is not going to be able to perform a tour de force of aeronautical skill. These are people that would have had a hard time getting a driver's license in most states. And this is Wisniewski's 9/11 book, one of the bestsellers in Germany, and of course he's put a television program on German primetime news. Another question, were the alleged phone messages from the passengers and the crew authentic? Somehow a lot depends on whether Barbara Olson really said the things she was alleged to have said. These messages have never really been officially published. Various parts of them have been made public, and they're highly suspect. As, for example, Andreas von Bülow argued in his book on the CIA and the 11th of September, it's within the repertory of a serious intelligence agency to be able to have imitators who can sound like somebody. Under conditions of stress, they can convince acquaintances, even friends of somebody, maybe the connection is bad or something like this. They can essentially mimic the voice of somebody. And a lot of these phone calls are to people that are not within the immediate circle or family of the people involved. Why were no arrests ever made for insider trading? How can it be possible that the SEC and all these other agencies cannot track down people who made these colossal bets on airline stocks? Why was there no air defense? What was the reason for the stand down? Why were there no interceptors? The long-established standard operating procedures of the Federal Aeronautics Administration, the North American Air Defense Command, were all simply flaunted. And it's a case of incompetence that is relatively circumscribed. Before and after, these things tended not to happen, but on this day, essentially, all the rules were simply suspended. And there'd be a lot to say about each one of them. Obviously, each one of the 14 points hides hundreds of individual questions. Then there's the problem that, by and large, historically, modern fireproof skyscrapers do not collapse as a result of fire. The Meriden Plaza Hotel in Philadelphia in the early 1990s burned until it was a gutted shell, but it did not collapse. So was the World Trade Center a case of controlled demolition? Were charges incorporated into the static structure of the building? Gerhard Wisniewski shows photographs that this is the case, that this is what was done. One of the problems, of course, is that in the case of the second plane hitting the South Tower, the majority of the kerosene was burned in this huge cloud that you see, and therefore was not available to stoke the fire on the inside of the building. Ironically, this building collapsed before the North Tower. And then even more puzzling, what happened to Building 7 of this complex, a 40-story skyscraper in most cities, which collapsed in the afternoon? And there's a very suspicious exchange of comments between the owner of the complex and various authorities, which raises the question again of controlled demolition. This happened at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Then we have the question of what hit the Pentagon. And I'm afraid that all the physical evidence in particular points to the fact that the impact signature, the hole in the side of the building, is much too small for a Boeing 757 to have been involved. It's got to be something else, and that raises a whole series of other questions. The person who has argued this perhaps most eloquently is Thierry Meyssan of the Réseau Voltaire in Paris. His book Pentagate was the first one to say, whatever hit the Pentagon, it was not a Boeing 757 commercial airliner. Related question, what crashed in Shanksville, and how did it crash? The book that's just come out now in the last couple of weeks, David Ray Griffin, The New Pearl Harbor, suggests, following the Thompson timeline, that United Airlines 93 was shot down because the passengers had been successful in seizing control of the aircraft, and that somebody didn't want to have an aircraft to be examined and supposed hijackers to be interrogated. So this would be an equivalent of Jack Ruby eliminating the evidence in the Kennedy assassination. What explains Bush's behavior on September 11th? The long reading lesson, the flying around in Air Force One at low levels, going to Louisiana, going to Nebraska. And the related question, was a threat received by the White House, a threat against Bush's aircraft or some other threat, that incorporated within it top secret code words, for example, Angel, which is according to Woodward and some others, and William Safire, was the code word for Air Force One. Here's David Ray Griffin, his new book, The New Pearl Harbor. I'm proud to say that he's an IITC supporter. He assigned the call. The 11th point, why was the Islamic world blamed on the basis of absolutely no evidence pointing to the Islamic world? Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda are, of course, longstanding CIA assets. The way that this was done seems to have more to do with Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations thesis, with the Richard Pearl clean break, with the William Crystal Project for a New American Century, and so forth, than with any evidence growing out of this case. It seems to simply be a pre-existing prejudice kicking in. Generally speaking, people have accepted the idea that Bush and the administration lied wildly on Iraq. I don't think it's too much to ask people to consider that they may have lied on these other matters. Again, the identification of bin Laden, naturally he seems to have taken credit, but this has absolutely no standing. Any police agency in the world has to have tests to see if somebody who confesses to a crime actually has enough inside knowledge of the crime to have been able to carry it out. Otherwise, you get what's called in some languages a mythomaniac, somebody who tries to become famous by confessing to some heinous crime that he did not commit. And, of course, the inevitable exploitation of this for psychological warfare purposes. What explains the drive for a totalitarian state? There clearly is one. The question is, what is the point? What explains the shift to preemptive aggression? Is it, as Mike and Ruppert and others have argued, declining world oil production? Is it an attempt to preserve the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency? Is it the fact that we're in a very severe world economic depression? Is it all of these? In other words, the motivation for the group of people that are now running the show. And I think the most important question, who are the real September criminals? And I don't think we have any idea of this, and I think it's time to think about at least drawing up categories of suspect, not individuals, but classes of people, and seeing where they intersect. And if somebody shows up as being a member of 10 or 15 classes of suspect individuals and is in a position to carry something out like this, then that's where the investigation should be involved. Now, let's say a couple of words about the faction that is running this entire show. The Bush machine, I submit, is a CIA, Brown Brothers Harriman, Skull and Bones, Bush family, neocon, oligarch faction. It has all of those components, as I've shown in the book from 1992. We have Skull and Bones, this secret society at Yale University. It's important largely because of the Harriman Investment Bank. Bush is a third-generation member. Senator Kerry is also a member. And both of them observe the Skull and Bones rule, that you're not allowed to talk about Skull and Bones. And I would have to say, come, Senator Kerry, that won't do. We won't vote for you, at least unless you come forward and talk to us about Skull and Bones. If you're still controlled by the discipline of the society, that won't do. This is the death symbol, 322, the symbol of Skull and Bones. And here is the tomb, the mausoleum, where they meet on the campus of Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Now, I have to talk to you about the Nazi links of the Bush family. This generally involves Prescott Bush, Fritz Thyssen, and Hitler. Fritz Thyssen, of course, was the main financier of the Nazi Party starting in the 1920s. And he had a bank in New York City called the Union Banking Corporation, which was the center of a group of companies, pardon the typo, here in the U.S. Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the current usurper in the White House, was a director and shareholder in the Union Banking Corporation. There is Fritz Thyssen, a German industrialist and financier. There's his book, I Paid Hitler. And he did. And he was trying to get off the hook with this. He was trying to say, I paid him, but I stopped paying him. It was written about 1940. Here's Hitler, here's Thyssen, and here are two executives of the United Steelworks, which is a Thyssen company in which the Harriman Investment Bank, Prescott Bush, managing partner, had significant interests. There are other companies, Bush-Harriman companies, that were seized as Nazi property during the war, including the United Steelworks that we've just seen, plus these others. And here it is as a graphic. Here's Thyssen. Here's Prescott Bush at Brown Brothers Harriman. Here's Bush 41, Bush 43. Over here we have Hitler and the Nazi Party. So we've got Prescott Bush acting as the banker for Thyssen in Manhattan. This links then to the German military-industrial complex through some of those companies that we've seen. We've got Standard Oil. This is another one. A man called Farish, who was the head in 1940 of the Standard Oil Company and was part of the worldwide Standard Oil IG Farben cartel. These two companies between them were part of the management of the Auschwitz concentration camp. And just to round out the picture, Bush 43 has chosen to represent him at the Court of St. James in London, in other words, ambassador to Great Britain, William Stamps Farish III, who's the grandson of the head of Standard Oil, who was part of the cartel with I.G. Farben and who was condemned in the American press for being practically a traitor because of these activities during World War II. This Farish was also the manager of Bush 41's blind trust when Bush 41 was vice president and indeed president. In October of 1942, under the provisions of the Trading with the Enemy Act, the Union Banking Corporation was seized as a Nazi-controlled bank by order of the alien property custodian. Prescott Bush, once again, was director of shareholder in the Union Banking Corporation. Here's the story. This is before the seizure. This is in 1941, the old Herald Tribune. And here we see a picture of Thyssen. Let's look more closely. Thyssen has $3 million cash in New York vaults. Union Banking Corporation may hide nest egg for high Nazis he once backed. And then if you read the article, maybe he's still backing them. Prescott Bush is mentioned twice in this article. Here's the jump. Thyssen has $3 million cash in a bank that's been functioning on Wall Street since 1924. Now, here are the three possible accusations against Prescott Bush. It may be that he helped to finance the Nazi seizure of power. The bank emerged in 24. Hitler comes to power in 33. There's a period of virtual civil war before that. The Nazis needed money. Some of that money might have come through those Thyssen companies as profits being sent to Holland and then into Germany. Prescott Bush is also implicated in the cartel that administered the Auschwitz death camp. When Bush went to Auschwitz in the past 6 months, the Réseau Voltaire cited my book and talked about this possibility. And the Polish press also mentioned this. And thirdly, Prescott Bush is implicated in industries that produced weapons to kill American soldiers. So three important accusations. The Bush family fortune as a whole is tainted by profits from Nazi-controlled companies and possibly from the death camps. So the Bush family emerges as merchants of death from the days of Thyssen to the days of the Carlyle Group. Now, I'm happy to say that my efforts have forced the Bush family to answer. Here we have a foreword by Bush 41. Duty, honor, country, the life and legacy of Prescott Bush. Mickey Herskowitz is a baseball writer. The only person that they could get to do this was somebody whose previous works include, you know, The Life of Mickey Mantle or things of this sort. So he was trotted out to write this, and of course there's about half a page on the Thyssen question, and of course it's all a terrible misunderstanding. Now, one of the things that I would also point out that's closer, let's look at the Bushes and terrorism. Let's look at the attempt to kill President Reagan in 1981 and what the Bush role there was. Reagan was wounded. It was March 31st, 1981. And then we see in the Houston Post this article. Let's look closer. Bush's son was to dine with suspect's brother. It turns out that Neil Bush, the brother of the current tenant, had a close personal relation with Scott Hinckley, the brother of the gunman and would-be assassin. It's confirmed. The jump. Bush's son was to dine with shooting suspect's brother. The next day, Bush's vice presidential office confirms his son Neil was to have hosted Hinckley's brother on the night of the assassination, the evening of the assassination. And here's Neil Bush. This is the Rocky Mountain News. Neil Bush's press conference in Denver. He says, yes, it's true. I was a friend. I am a friend of Scott Hinckley. Bush Hinckley's sons had appointment. Now, I hope you'll agree with me that we have here the appearance of a conflict of interest. Which would require, in a government of laws, it would require an investigation. But there never was an investigation because the vice president presided over the cabinet and said Hinckley had acted alone. Now, more recently, some of the themes of my book have been developed in this American dynasty by Kevin Phillips. You know him. He's basically a Republican. He's the one who thought up the Southern strategy that we've been suffering under ever since. It is, in intelligence parlance, a limited hangout on the crimes of the Bush dynasty. One of his findings is that my book contains massive research, but that I'm a paranoid. I am somebody who is wandering a wasteland of paranoid snowdrifts. Now, I want to share this not so much because of anything with me, but this is, of course, what happens to all of us as soon as we begin to talk about important issues in this society, right, given the philistinism that we have to deal with. Let's just talk for a second about this. Conspiracy theory. The official version is, of course, absurd. It's impossible. It's contradictory. And the only thing they can do is to vilify you if you come forward and try to advance some facts. Bush himself has said that conspiracy theories are not allowed. Well, let's look back. Here we have the U.S. Declaration of Independence, which talks about a long train of abuses and usurpations that invariably pursue the same object. And it shows a design to reduce the colonies to absolute despotism. In other words, a whole bunch of things have happened, but they're all the result of a single plan. They're all usurpations. They have the direct object, the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. Well, don't look now, but Thomas Jefferson and his editor, Benjamin Franklin, are both conspiracy theorists because the U.S. Declaration of Independence incorporates a conspiracy theory. There's no other way to describe it. But don't stop there. How about this one? The House Divided speech by Abraham Lincoln, 1858. This is a little bit longer. But he says, well, we can't absolutely know that all of these exact adaptations are the result of preconcert, or conspiracy. He's talking about the extension of slavery into the territories. But when you see a lot of framed timbers that have been gotten out at different times by different workmen, Stephen Douglas, Franklin Pierce, a senator, a president, Roger Taney, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the Dred Scott decision, and James Buchanan, if you see that a bunch of parts have been assembled from these different people, and then you see they join together, that they make something, in that case, we find it impossible not to believe that Stephen and Franklin and Roger and James all understood each other from the beginning and all worked upon a common plan or draft drawn before the first lick was struck. So the most famous speech in American history Now, I've got to hurry along, so please bear with me. Lincoln's attitude also was, at his time, the big issue was the Mexican War, and the Polk government, I see there's a street named after this guy here, if I'm not mistaken, said, we were attacked on our own territory. And Lincoln said, yeah, show me where. I want to know the spot resolutions of Lincoln when he was a congressman. He refused to accept the official version, and he was baited by Douglas in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. He was called Spotty Lincoln. So his attitude was not, I believe in the official version. His attitude was, I want proof. And I would suggest to you that that's the American attitude that ought to be followed today. Even for Republicans. When the Republican Party campaigned successfully for the first time in 1860, the platform was, largely, the slogan, was the slave power conspiracy developed by Seward, who became Secretary of State, and others, and with that they won the White House. So the Republican Party is built on a conspiracy theory. The only question is, which conspiracy theory? I would suggest no political action is possible without some kind of a coherent explanation of what's going on in the world. And you have to remember that we live in an oligarchy. The characteristic way that an oligarchy works is by conspiracy. And all of this stuff about conspiracy theory goes back to Richard Hofstadter, 1964, the paranoid style. And it's suspicious because it comes right in the wake of the Kennedy assassination. Another problem he had was that Europeans were more interested in the conspiracy than Americans, so the American paranoid diagnosis didn't work well for him. Now, very, very quickly, I just want to show you the notion of using terrorist acts on the 9/11 model is a classic political tool of this British-American financier faction. I'm just going to have to whip through these very quickly. Here's an example. Guy Fawkes and the Gunpowder Plot. 400 years. It created a period of 200 years of war with Spain. Here's Guy Fawkes, right? Remember, he was going to blow up the Houses of Parliament. He's caught, hanged, and so forth. Here is the crew. Guy Fawkes and his fellow conspirators, the Patsies. And I think this is correct. Here's an analysis that alleges that the traditional official story is not true. What was the Gunpowder Plot? And it points largely to the Prime Minister of Britain, Lord Cecil. He is the main suspect in organizing the Gunpowder Plot. Now, they've succeeded for 400 years with this one, and it's still a holiday that is celebrated on the 5th of November every year in Britain. If you've been there, you've seen it. Later on, they had to sort of correct this. They had something called the Popish Plot about 75 years later. In the Gunpowder, it was Spain and the Pope, and they had to adjust that to make it France and the Pope. So that was this one. The USS Maine, Havana Harbor, you know the story. Here's a Hearst Press story of how it was done, a mine with these evil Spaniards over here going to blow it up. Hyman Rickover, the father of the nuclear navy, did a study that showed that the explosion had come from inside the ship and therefore could not have been the Spanish. Then we have Operation Northwoods, the plan to start a war with Cuba. That turned then was later done in the form of the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Here's the actual paper, March 1962, signed by General Lyman Lemnitzer, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And by the way, if anybody ever says there are no conspiracies, this document, signed by the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, shows a way to fake, through conspiracy, a series of terrorist actions, including blowing people up in Miami and New York. Now, one last point that I hope I can make. We hear a lot about the ideology or belief structure of different groups in the world. Let's look at the neocons, the group that has taken over the government, and let's look at their guru, Leo Strauss. Now, Leo Strauss has a lot of strange points. He talks about lying. There's one truth for the elite, there's another version for the masses. It's a kind of doublethink. They talk about war, but they don't want to go. And their basic idea seems to be that if you want to have a society based on special privilege, you need an enemy image in order to survive. There's Leo Strauss, the neocon pope, for many years professor of politics at the University of Chicago. This is his lineage. I call it the neocon family tree. Nietzsche, Heidegger, Carl Schmitt. Heidegger and Schmitt, card-carrying Nazis. Nietzsche claimed by the Nazis as their ancestor. And from Leo Strauss, we then get Huntington, Wolfowitz, Crystal, Pearl, Feith, Schulsky, Luthi, Woolsey, Scooter Libby, the entire crew that has taken over the United States government. Now, Schmitt is the one that I would like to focus on. Schmitt is the one who says that war and fighting are the essence of humanity, and that peace and equality destroy the human spirit. And I'm not kidding. It seems impossible from the point of view of normal, everyday life. But they're interested in coups, they're interested in putches, they're interested in dictatorships, and not just in theory. Schmidt was the designer of the constitutional loophole that allowed Hitler to take power. And, of course, they don't like international law. They didn't like the League of Nations. They don't like the United Nations. Now, this is just to show the coup can be done under the color of law. Prussia, California, not culturally maybe, but being the biggest political subdivision of the two respective countries. Remember that before Hitler took power, there was a coup d'etat in Prussia in July of 1932. The Social Democratic government was ousted. Schmidt was the lawyer for that coup, and that was the basis for Hitler's coup just a few months later. In your state, you've just had a legal coup, which is obviously intended to be a springboard for a second coup attempt on the national level. This is the doctrine, and this is how they apply it. There's Carl Schmitt. Now, in the 1990s, the neocons were not happy. The Cold War had ended. The Oslo Peace Accord seemed to promise some kind of a normalization with Israel and the PLO. There was a Northern Ireland peace process. And the neocons look at that as threat of world peace, a situation in which the privileges and standing that they had built up as war hawks would be swept away. The enemy image would be no more. Now, here's what Leo Strauss says. The universal and homogeneous state, what he means by that is peace, progress, prosperity, justice. Normal people would like this. He says, if that's the way it's going to go, history is tragic. And if we get to that, it will show that the human problem is insoluble. But there will always be real men who will revolt. They may be forced into a mere negation of that universal and homogeneous state, into a negation not enlightened by any positive goal, a nihilistic negation. Now, of course, nihilistic negation can mean a lot, but one of the things that it can mean is terrorism. That nihilistic negation may be the only action on behalf of man's humanity, the only great and noble deed possible under the universal and homogeneous state. This successful revolt would take us back to the primitive horde. He's talking about a nihilistic revolution that would reduce civilization to the level of the Stone Age. And under this could be understood terrorism, war, genocide, mayhem, or any of the above. And these are the sacred texts of the neocons. So if somebody says to you, well, the Quran incites to violence, I think the appropriate answer is the neocon sacred books incite to something that looks to me like it covers just about anything, including everything that we've seen so far. And he wraps it up saying, workers and warriors of all countries unite while there is still time to prevent the coming of the realm of freedom. It is from a book called On Tyranny, 1963. Take a look. And this is now the group that controls the government of the United States. I think that's a shocking situation. And of course, Huntington is part of it, our friend Wolfowitz. Now, let me just end with perhaps a hopeful note. I'm looking back to the Russell Tribunal. I believe there's a man here today who was actually the executive director of the Russell Tribunal, and I'd love to meet him. In those days of 66 and 67, Lord Russell and Sartre got together with historians and civil rights activists and artists, the former president of Mexico, the feminist activist Simone de Beauvoir, Lelio Basso, the Italian socialist, Dave Dellinger, that some may remember, Isaac Deutscher, the historian, Carl Oglesby, a student activist, Peter Weiss, the German playwright. And they essentially constituted a panel of eminent personalities to hear evidence and to render a verdict, a finding, on the Johnson administration policy in Vietnam. They heard witnesses. The historian Gabriel Kolko is still around. Tariq Ali is still in the breach. Civil rights activists, lawyers, scientists, biochemists, mathematicians, even some former U.S. soldiers from Vietnam appeared. They had preparatory sessions in Japan, Vietnam, Denmark. They had support committees. And they provided, I think, a guide for the international peace movement, and they essentially turned every intellectual in the world against the war in Vietnam. And this is what I would suggest we have to do today with the 9/11 story. They were able to force Prime Minister of Britain, Foreign Secretary of Britain, U.S. Secretary of State, President of France to react in public. They helped to turn world opinion against the Vietnam War. They were then overtaken by the Tet Offensive, and Johnson soon resigned. I would hope, again, that between August, September of this year, once all the initiatives that I know of have played out, that there would be the possibility of holding such a independent international truth commission on 9/11 somewhere, be it in Canada, be it in London. It seems almost impossible to hold it in the United States because many of the key participants won't come here, don't feel that they can. So I would, I have one thing that I would ask everybody to do. I thought to myself, who could you have today who might be the chairman of such an independent international truth commission? Somebody who has spoken eloquently against the policies of the Bush administration, accusing Bush of attempting to sink the world into chaos. Well, Nelson Mandela, I think, would be an excellent candidate. If you can think of others, please do. There's his email. There's his address. And I would urge you, drop him a line, say, Mr. President, you should take on the task of chairing the Independent International Truth Commission on 9/11. The Kane-Hamilton Commission will play itself out in the next couple of months. It's clear that they'll go on begging the question and that they'll essentially come out with some kind of a rehash of the media version that we're so familiar with and which is so impossible, absurd, and contradictory. And I think we've got to lay the basis now with recruiting eminent personalities of this caliber, people of massive integrity, worldwide reputations for humanitarianism and love of the good, frankly, to come forward and not that they have to study 9/11 for 6 months or 12 months. They simply have got to sit in an auditorium like this and go through a series of 14 or 15 panels, whatever it is, and render a finding. In other words, to take all the work that's been done by all the activists on the internet and all the books and all the people that have devoted their time and their sweat and their long burning of the midnight oil to getting to the bottom of this, to listen to that and to come out with findings. There are differences of opinion. Some people say an airplane hit the Pentagon. I heard that on television this week. I don't see how this is possible. But whoever believes that should also come to the commission. One of the other things the commission will do is to issue high-profile public challenges to people like Colin Powell, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Bush, that they should appear and that they should defend their version if they think it's defendable. Maybe Condoleezza Rice will come forward for that one. So I urge you, therefore, to make use of that email address. We've already communicated with President Mandela. His schedule is full, but I think he's a political person, just like so many of us here, and that if a wave of interest comes forward, I think that he might be able to change some of the items in his schedule. And I'm sure we could work around everything if we could get him to participate. So I thank you very kindly for your attention.
You've been listening to author Webster Tarpley speaking on March 26th at the International Inquiry on 9/11 in San Francisco. Thanks to Mariah Gallardon of TUC Radio for providing us tapes of the proceedings. Next week, we'll present more speakers from the Citizens 9/11 Inquiry. For more information on the ongoing inquiry, visit on the web www.911truth.org. 911truth.org. And you can contact the program through our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.